U.S. lawmakers are sharply divided following Iran's attack on military bases housing American soldiers.
Democrats are going to spend a lot of time today talking to Republicans, trying to convince them that it is time to open a formal debate on the Senate floor about the president's war powers.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for January 8th, we'll look at next steps for the U.S. and Iran. Also on the show, even as more women are running for office, paying for childcare remains a major obstacle.
When men run for office, no one questions them if they're a parent. But if you're a mom and you're running for office at any level of government, even at the local level, the first question you will be asked is, what will you do with your kids while you're campaigning?
We'll start with more coverage on Iran. Let's get going.
Iran fires ballistic missiles at two bases used by U.S. troops in Iraq.
Iran struck back against the United States
in response to the U.S. drone killing of the Guard's top general.
The strikes by Iran appear to be somewhat tempered, not causing mass casualties.
Let me say tonight, if you're watching television in Iran, I just got off the phone to the president. Your fate is in your own hands in terms of the regime's economic viability. You continue this crap, you're going to wake up one day out of the oil business.
Look, when you go around assassinating leadership in governments, you are setting a precedent which says to any country on earth, hey, all we got to do is name these people terrorists, call them what you want, and we can assassinate them.
Iran appears to be standing down, which is a good thing for all parties concerned and a very good thing for the world. No Americans were harmed in last night's attack by the Iranian regime.
On Tuesday, Iran's military carried out its initial response to the United States killing of General Qasem Soleimani, firing over a dozen ballistic missiles at two military bases in Iraq that house U.S. soldiers. So far, no American or Iraqi casualties have been reported. Following the launch of the missiles, Iran's foreign minister Mohammad Javad Zarif wrote on Twitter that, quote, Iran took and concluded proportionate measures in self-defense under Article 51 of the U.N. Charter. Today, President Trump held a press conference where he said that Iran appears to be standing down at the moment, and in lieu of further military action, the U.S. will issue additional economic sanctions against Iran.
As we continue to evaluate options in response to Iranian aggression, the United States will immediately impose additional punishing economic sanctions on the Iranian regime. These powerful sanctions will remain until Iran changes its behavior.
Joining me now to discuss President Trump's response is Negar Mortazavi, diplomatic correspondent for The Independent. Thanks for joining us, Negar.
Thanks for having me.
We've seen a relatively subdued press conference from President Trump today. He said the U.S. was prepared to respond going forward, but said no military actions are planned right now. What do you make of this sort of de-escalation by the president?
Well, I think Iran planned an attack that was face-saving for them, but it was also strategic and calculated. Basically, they offered an exit ramp out of this very escalatory situation for President Trump, and it seems like President Trump took the exit. So they, the retaliation for the killing of Qasem Soleimani was something that was flashy, it was high profile, something that can be played on Iranian media over and over again, and it was a big threat or a warning that we are prepared and we have the capacity to attack you, your forces, your bases, from our soil. We do it publicly, not through proxies, not hiding behind other forces. But then at the same time, I think it was calculated to not have casualties, to basically offer this off-ramp and not see this as an escalation, but more a retaliation. At the same time, I think they're playing the long-term game in basically what they vowed to make the region, at least Iraq, unsafe for American forces. So eventually they leave, which was Iran's goal to begin with.
Nagar, in some place, in some ways, the president took the off-ramp with this de-escalation, but he did start by saying that Iran would have no nuclear weapon as long as he is in power. Now, Iran, it's said, it is walking away from several key components of the nuclear deal. The United States pulled out of the nuclear deal under President Trump. How does that square with the president's statement that he won't allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon?
Has been consistent with the president's basically policy and rhetoric from the beginning, even the previous administration. Basically, the purpose of the nuclear deal, the JCPOA, was to prevent Iran for having a nuclear deal or getting even close to a nuclear deal. And that was what the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, was actually supposed to ensure. What the president has done is pull out of that deal and basically give Iran more room and more leeway to get closer to a program. They're still not on a path to a nuclear weapons program, but they've definitely reduced their commitments under the deal to use that as a bargaining chip. So now their running position from Tehran is that you lift sanctions, which you impose after pulling out of the deal, and then in exchange for you lifting sanctions, we're going to return to the terms of the nuclear deal. So basically going back to what used to be 2 years ago.
The president also asked for NATO to step up its role in the Middle East and different allies. Is that something that the U.S. can even ask for right now, given the fact that we are part of the increasing tensions in the region? And I would suggest the president has been somewhat hypocritical given his own relationship with NATO.
His own relationship, his own rhetoric, and also the fact that we have to remember when he pulled out of the nuclear deal, none of his NATO allies, basically his closest European allies, were on board with him. In fact, they've been opposing him along this way, warning him to not pull out of the deal, not basically push Iran into the corner that he's been pushing them. So, yes, I think there's a contradiction in what the president is saying, but it also is a spirit of desperation, I would say. He specifically called on UK, France, Germany, Russia, and China, all of the signatories of the deal, to basically break away from the JCPOA, saying the deal is expiring soon anyways, and then come up to basically be on board with him for a new deal, which doesn't seem likely anytime soon, at least between Iran and this administration.
Nagar, the president has also said, tried to strike a conciliatory tone, at least with the people of Iran, saying that he wants peace, that he wants to make a deal that allows Iranians to thrive. At this point, given where we are, is anyone in Iran's government likely to come to the negotiating table with the United States, at least on that front at the moment, given these increasing sanctions?
No, I think publicly, the way it was done with the Obama administration, there's almost zero chance. There's no chance for anyone in Iran basically being able to pay the political cost of meeting with anyone at this administration. Still, could back channel start? Yes, that's a possibility. We know under hardline President Ahmadinejad, there were also some back channel attempts. So there could be something like that happening, talks for prisoner swaps, the potential prisoner swaps between Iran and the U.S., which the Iranians have been offering. But then at the same time, Iranians have been saying all along that if the U.S. lifts sanctions and is willing to return to the P5+1, so all the signatories of the multilateral deal, they're willing to sit down and negotiate with the U.S. at the table. But nothing that's a public one-on-one that basically we saw under President Obama, which happened, by the way, after sustained and meaningful de-escalation between Washington and Tehran. So the negotiations with President Obama also didn't come out of nowhere.
Nagar Mortazavi is a diplomatic correspondent for The Independent. Thanks, Nagar.
Thanks for having me.
For more analysis on the latest developments between the United States and Iran, I'm joined by Farnaz Fasihi, a reporter who writes about Iran for The New York Times. Farnaz, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, Tanzina.
So, Farnaz, after Iran's missile attack yesterday, what are you watching for as the rest of the week unfolds in terms of U.S.-Iranian relations?
I think what we really have to watch for is whether there will be more attacks on U.S. or U.S. interests through Iran's proxy groups in the region. Both Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Shia militia groups, Hashad Shaabi and Kataib Hezbollah in Iraq, have said that if their response is separate from Iran's response, and they reserve the right to target the U.S. Because one of their senior commanders had also been killed, and because General Soleimani was viewed as really a regional cult figure. So what we have to watch is if direct confrontation with the U.S. and Iran sees, we have to really watch and see whether things will escalate with these proxy groups.
There's also been lots of criticism here in the United States, particularly among Democratic lawmakers, but I imagine this extends to the international community as well, to a certain extent, about the intelligence that led to the killing of General Soleimani, that it was relatively thin. Have you heard anything, Farnaz, about the intelligence and whether or not the case that the United States has made prior to the attack that killed Soleimani has been solidified more?
Heard that the U.S. claims that General Soleimani was about to plot an attack on Americans is correct or not. We haven't really seen much evidence from the White House. I think Democratic politicians, even international partners, we're hearing from diplomats that they're not satisfied with the level of information that they're getting that justifies this attack. The Iraqi Prime Minister said General Soleimani was in Iraq on an official invitation from the Prime Minister, that he was there to talk to him about Iran-Saudi relations and give a message for Saudi Arabia. Some of my sources are saying that General Soleimani was in Iraq after the embassy attack on the U.S. and after some of the military base that killed an American contractor, and he was sort of there to strategize and see where things happen next. I mean, he was a figure that traveled freely and widely around the Middle East. I think he, while Iran and General Soleimani probably always thought that they might be a target, but because the U.S. had sort of tolerated his existence over the years and intentionally decided not to take him out, that he felt like he had a certain level of impunity to conduct his operations around the region. So this really came as a surprise to the shock to the Iranians. What I'm hearing from the Iranians is that things had not gotten to a point with the U.S. that justified going to the brink of war. There was a parallel track of diplomacy happening through Japan. President Rouhani had gone to meet Japan's prime minister and tried to restart the possibility of negotiations with the U.S. There was a lot of regional back-channeling to de-escalate with Saudi Arabia. So from the view of the Iranians, they thought that they had reinvigorated the possibility of talks, and they did not see this coming at all.
Farnaz, what, if any, response have you heard from regional leaders, either in Iraq or Saudi Arabia, for example?
Regional leaders have been sounding alarm bells that they do not want to get caught in a war between Iran and the U.S. Geographically, they're very close to Iran. They also, many of them, house U.S. bases, as I mentioned, and they could be at risk of getting attacked. And in places like United Arab Emirates and Dubai and Qatar, there's been a lot of financial investments and tourism and business interests that could be at stake if there's war. And just a lot of financial concerns, as well as the concerns of, people getting killed and instability. As we saw, Iraq's prime minister also said that the Iranians had warned him that the attack was coming, but he is calling for calm and for things to be dialed down because Iraq is really in the middle of this, in the eye of this storm between U.S. and Iran.
Farnaz Fasihi is a reporter who writes about Iran for The New York Times. Farnaz, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Joining me now to talk about how lawmakers are responding to Trump's Iran strike and the retaliation by Iran is Lisa Desjardins, correspondent for PBS NewsHour. Thanks for coming on the show, Lisa.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I'm sure you've been hearing a lot from folks on both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, following Iran's ballistic missile attack on two Iraqi bases that housed U.S. soldiers last night. Tell me about what the Democrats are telling you.
Democrats, I think the best way to categorize their reaction is that they're highly concerned. They're not sure what the president's strategy was before Iran retaliated, and they're not sure what it is now. One person to watch is Senator Dick Durbin. He's the number two Democrat in the U.S. Senate. And last night, while most lawmakers were tweeting out We are praying for U.S. service members. We are monitoring the situation. He tweeted out that he thinks it is now the responsibility of Congress to decide whether to declare war, and that he wrote, "Stand up, colleagues." That's a call for the Senate specifically to vote to limit the president's war powers right now on this specific issue. It does not seem that the votes are there at this moment, but because there are so many questions about what the president's strategy is, Democrats are going to spend a lot of time today talking to Republicans, trying to convince them that it is time to open a formal debate on the Senate floor about the president's war powers.
I want to get into the Republican response in just a moment, but you mentioned Dick Durbin's call for his colleagues to step up. And I'm wondering, the House is expected to vote on a resolution that would rein in some of Trump's power to attack Iran without congressional approval. Where does that vote stand?
That's right. That vote is expected in the next 2 days in the House. That is expected to pass. You know, that resolution really just limits the president to military engagement with Iran. The idea is that it would stop a wider war with Iran. It would not affect potentially some of the more surgical strikes that the president has been doing, such as the strike on Soleimani itself, which was not on Iranian territory, but on Iraqi territory. Or at least it leaves open the possibility that the president could continue strikes like that, which remains an open question. Congress, since the Korean War, has had a real issue in flexing oversight of these kinds of military actions by presidents. And it remains to be seen if Congress really does anything new here to try and limit the president's powers. But the House will try to limit the president's ability to open a wider war with Iran. It's not clear what will happen to that resolution when it goes to the Senate.
What's the Republican response been to the Iran ballistic missile attack?
You know, it's varied. Some Republicans, including Lindsey Graham, who is also very important to watch because he's close to the president and he's a hawk when it comes to Iran, have said that Iran should be happy that there wasn't more damage, because if there is more damage, if there were U.S. lives confirmed to be taken, that then, in Lindsey Graham's words, then Iran would lose its entire oil industry, meaning a threat from the U.S. to take out Iran's oil and energy sector. So there are many Republicans saying if Iran continues this, if there are loss of American lives, that the U.S. will respond with even greater force. There are other Republicans who are saying simply, we want to know more about what's happening. We want to know more about the president's strategy, and we're going to let time kind of help us understand the situation. Someone in that category is Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate. He has said that members understandably have questions and concerns about what's happening, but he has asked them to wait until the president and his staff brief them, which is expected today. And he said, let's hold off on making judgments until we hear from the president.
Kentucky Senator Rand Paul is one of the few GOP senators who's criticized the Trump administration for killing Soleimani. Where does he stand on this?
Well, he is a longtime anti-interventionist, and he thinks that this is a huge mistake. Almost immediately after word came of the strike against Soleimani, Rand Paul was on Twitter and on Fox News telling the president, you ran as someone who said he would end perpetual war. This is a step toward perpetual war, which is really a striking thing for such an ally of the president to say. Rand Paul thinks this is a grave mistake. And it's a fascinating dynamic because Rand Paul golfs with the president just like Lindsey Graham does. And it almost as if those are the two voices on either side of the president. One counseling complete restraint, the other counseling intervention. And right now it looks like that intervention voice is the one that the president hears more loudly.
There's been criticism of the intelligence that the White House claims it had before killing Soleimani. Has that been clarified at all? Have we learned more about the content of that intelligence so far?
No, that is the most important question, I think, right now, is the rationale and the evidence behind the president's original strike, the evidence that there was, in fact, a threat against American lives and American interests from Soleimani. We know yesterday that the Secretary of Defense told reporters that the threat was for something that would happen within days, or more likely days than weeks. And that was the first sort of definitive time frame we had heard in public from him. We know that the several members of Congress were briefed yesterday, including the so-called Gang of Eight, the top leaders in the House and Senate and on the intelligence committees. And you know, some of them came out of that briefing, and we'd heard from other members who were briefed as well, saying that they did not get specific information about exactly the nature of the threat, that they felt that they needed more. Some senators said that the information in the briefing was told them, they were told it was classified, they can't talk about it, but they also questioned whether it should be classified, that they felt it could be too vague to be classified. Essentially, there are many questions still about it, about that rationale and about the evidence that there was a threat.
Lisa, there are some parallels here to the run-up in Iraq in 2003. I think particularly when we look at the intelligence that led to the Iraq war. Are you seeing similar parallels in terms of the political strategy that's playing out?
You know, I think it's too soon to tell, but absolutely. That is the Iraq war is a huge shadow over this moment. And the fact that we know that the evidence that the Bush administration so strongly guaranteed the world they had, that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and was ready to use them, we know that evidence was based on completely faulty intelligence, and that in fact he did not have those weapons ready to deploy at the time. And at that point, you know, that was an argument that the Bush administration made on the floor of the United Nations. Here, we don't even know what the argument is exactly from President Trump. But I do think that's one reason that reporters, and I think to some degree Americans, want to know exactly what the evidence is. What can the administration share with us? This is a very serious step the administration has taken. And now Iran is engaging in a military way with our military, striking at Americans in an act of war. And we don't know exactly what precipitated this. So the Iraq war hangs over this very heavily.
Outside of what's happening in the Middle East, here in the United States, the president is facing an impeachment trial. Where does that stand in the Senate?
We have nothing but questions for you from Washington today. Very few answers.
Okay.
Nancy Pelosi still has not transmitted the articles of impeachment or the names of the House managers who will handle the articles of impeachment to the Senate. She can do it at any time. And the trial will officially begin one day after she transmits those articles. That'll be a formal opening. Then they'll set a schedule so that we'll know when the arguments would happen. She is waiting because the Democrats believe they are gaining momentum in their calls for witnesses. You know, Democrats and Pelosi's staff really, and she herself, it seems, believe that Senator McConnell does not plan to run a fair trial, that they do want to have the Senate call witnesses such as John Bolton or Mick Mulvaney, who may know what exactly the president said and did. And right now, it's not clear that that will happen. McConnell says he's ready to start the trial with just basic opening statements, and he will leave it up to the Senate later on whether to call witnesses. So there's a real standoff over this question of witnesses. I think in the end, there could be the votes in the Senate to call some of these witnesses because there are at least four Republicans who seem interested in that idea and would vote with Democrats. But right now, Nancy Pelosi would like, it seems, further guarantees on that, or at least she wants to know how exactly McConnell would start this trial. I think in the next few days, by early next week, we'll have a better idea of when this is going to start.
Speaking of potential witnesses, John Bolton is one of those folks, and he is the former national security advisor, and he said he would testify if the Senate subpoenaed him. How consequential would that be?
You know, that has made a lot of headlines, but I may be in a minority. I don't think this is a change in position for him. I think what it is he's broadcasting his position more. He had said before that he would even testify before the House Intelligence Committee. He was open to that idea if he was subpoenaed. They did not subpoena him in the House. They felt that he, for some reason, they decided not to do that at that time. So I don't think this is a new position for him. It doesn't surprise me. But he clearly is someone who wants to testify, but only under subpoena. He feels that there are executive office issues. He's been told by the White House, as have most witnesses there, not to testify, and he feels a subpoena would allow him to do so.
Lisa Desjardins is a PBS NewsHour correspondent. Lisa, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I'm Helga Davis, and my show is all about the art of fearless conversation.
The wonder of dialogue is that what you think is so obvious gets really questioned at a deep level.
Sometimes the truth is having those uncomfortable discussions that get to facts that we usually don't want to talk about.
Join me for a new season of Helga, wherever you get podcasts.
A record number of women ran for office in 2018, and experts say that trend is expected to continue in 2020. But for many of these candidates, paying for childcare is a major hurdle, and it can sometimes mean the difference between being able to run and having to call off a campaign.
When men run for office, no one questions them if they're a parent. But if you're a mom and you're running for office at any level of government, even at the local level, the first question you will be asked is, what will you do with your kids while you're campaigning?
That's Luba Gretchen Shirley. She's a former congressional candidate for New York's 2nd District and the founder of Vote Mama, a political action committee focused on electing Democratic mothers. And when she launched her congressional campaign in 2018, her children were 1 and 3 years old.
They were with me during the day, and then my mom, who's a public school teacher, would come home at 3:30 every day, and she would watch them then, and that's when I would start my work day.
At times, Luba says it was difficult to balance the responsibilities of childcare and running for Congress on Eastern Long Island, and for the first 6 months, she strapped her baby to her chest as she made the rounds at campaign events. In March 2018, Luba decided to petition the FEC to allow campaign money to help cover the cost of a babysitter. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton then sent a letter of support, as did 24 members of Congress.
I needed to put this request into the Federal Election Commission. And frankly, everybody told me I was crazy. They said, don't do this. It's a political suicide and you will get attacked for it. And I didn't have an option. There was no way I was going to be able to continue the campaign without that support.
But the FEC unanimously approved Luba's request in May 2018, making her the first woman to use campaign funds for childcare expenses. The ruling also meant that anyone running for federal office could do the same moving forward. Luba was able to hire a daytime babysitter for the rest of her 2018 campaign, though she ultimately lost the race to longtime Republican incumbent Peter King.
It literally made all the difference in the world. I was able to focus more. I was able to be at more events. I was able to do more call time. It enabled me to continue my campaign, and it changed the way that parents run for office in this country.
Well, at least on the national stage, because when it comes to running for state or local office, there's still no consensus on using campaign money to pay for childcare, and it looks very different from state to state. So for more on this, we're joined now by Jean Sinsdak, Associate Director of the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University. Jean, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So childcare has become a bigger hurdle for people running for office recently. Is that just because there are more women running for office, or they're being more vocal about it?
I think they're being more vocal about it. I think the childcare issue has been a hurdle for candidates since the dawn of time. And what we're seeing now, though, is that, you know, this rise in record number of women running for office, more and more of them are saying, wait a minute, this has been a barrier for me and we should do something about it.
We've had many men run for office and we haven't really heard about this issue coming from them. Is that because the assumption is that women will be the people taking care of the children?
Oh, yeah. So women have disproportionately shouldered the burden for childcare responsibilities, and they still do. I mean, research still shows they're still doing twice as much childcare as men are. For women, it's a particularly burdensome issue that they're expected to culturally and have been the ones that have shouldered the burden. So it's really important for women candidates to have access to something that lightens that burden to actually make it possible for them to run for office.
Childcare, especially, I mean, I'm going to imagine across the country, but here in New York, it is not cheap. How does that factor in to creating this barrier for women in particular? And I'm sure that would extend to other barriers like socioeconomic status and race and other things.
Right. Yeah. Well, as we all know, childcare is enormously expensive and, you know, hard to find in this country. So it's something that we've grappled with in all areas of our lives here in the U.S. But, you know, as we're talking about candidates right now, it's just something that comes up again and again and again.
Jean, stick with us. We're going to have more on paying for childcare when running for office in a moment. This is The Takeaway. Jean, again, we heard just from Luba Gretchen Shirley earlier on, a former candidate for office, and the FEC now allows women running at the federal level to use campaign funds to cover childcare. What about at the local and state level?
Well, so this is what was interesting about it. And we started this national conversation. And I think after that FEC ruling in 2018, a number of people, you know, at the state and local level said, hey, wait a minute, this is really interesting. I should find out if I'm allowed to use my campaign funds for campaign related childcare. And so it sort of started a flood of women writing to their, you know, looking into the issue to see if it was even allowed in the first place, or writing into their election, local election commissions to find out if they could get permission. And so for those of us who were observing all this and trying to track it, it's been really interesting. What we found is it varies widely around the country. There are actually only 6 states that allow it legally. You know, they pass legislation that says it's an allowable expense for candidates. What's interesting is they've pretty much all been in the last few years that they've passed this legislation. So this national conversation has actually sparked policy outcomes.
Has this issue sort of cut across party lines?
It has cut across party lines, and interestingly, also had a lot of bipartisan support. In Utah, it passed. It had a lot of Republican support in other states. New York State is another place that passed legislation recently, and, you know, a lot of Democratic support. But what we've seen is that it has support across the aisle. And so it's really something that is not related to partisan differences. You know, everyone needs childcare. So it really crosses across the aisle.
Are we seeing pushback? Are there any states or individuals who are saying, no, this is not the best way to use campaign funds?
Well, it was interesting what happened in Louisiana. A candidate for state office approached her elections board and asked if she could, you know, use her campaign funds for childcare. And they said no. And it actually was met with a tremendous public outcry, and they reversed their decision after that. Also in Tennessee, someone proposed a bill that would allow the practice, but it never made it out of committee, the elections committee in their legislature. And in both those cases, you know, men who were in the position to make decisions had said something along the lines of, you know, people should figure this out for themselves. This is a personal issue. But what they've seen, I think, is a lot of pushback on that. And a lot of that comes from how many women are running for office and saying, hey, wait a minute, this isn't fair.
Are there any men that are taking advantage of this?
I'm sure that there are. And actually, that's the good thing about this, that if you're, you know, a working parent, you know, a man or a woman, this is a good thing for you. I know there are men in the past, as when we've gone through and looked at other states to see what's happening. There have been male candidates that have requested to use campaign funds for childcare and been approved for it. So it's not without precedent. And so that's a really important point, even though I think this will most immediately affect a lot of women. It's really great for male candidates who have young children as well.
You know, we're talking here about campaign funds being used for people who are running for office, which is a very small percentage of the population. Do you see this conversation finally extending itself to people who are not running for office, American citizens who need childcare support in some way, shape or form?
Well, absolutely. I think the most interesting thing to me about all of this is the start of this national conversation about this particular issue. As you said, it's a very small segment of the population, but it's the first time we've ever seen, you know, the center's almost 50 years old. And it's the first time any of us can remember such a conversation about this particular barrier for entry into politics. But you're also talking about the people who will be in office and making policy decisions, including childcare and, you know, other issues that affect families. So, you know, the fact that you're making it possible for more people who really relate to those issues to be in office and make those decisions, it's only going to help shape, you know, continue to help shape the national culture and the conversation around childcare and the burden for working families.
Jean Sinsdak is the Associate Director of the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University. Jean, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.